his speech to the World Economic Forum in January 2026, the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney proclaimed the death of the rules-based international order. In its place, he announced the arrival of a new era of intensifying great power rivalry, where the most powerful pursue their interests using economic integration as coercion. For many, Carney's words provided a long overdue recognition of a new geopolitical reality. Globalization is fracturing, crises are multiplying, and conflicts in Europe and the Middle East have brought an end to the long post-Cold War peace dividend. Amid the disruption, there is a pervasive sense that the old rules have broken down, and a very different world is now emerging. But what does this emerging geopolitical landscape look like? Can democracy survive in a chaotic world governed by great power rivalry? And how can Europe rise to the challenges of a more unstable international system? This is Jack Dickens, commissioning editor at Engelsberg Ideas. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Leonard, co-founder and director at the European Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to discuss his new book, Surviving Chaos: Geopolitics When the Rules Fail. Mark, a warm welcome to the EI podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm a huge fan.
At its heart, your book is about Europe and how Europe can surmount the challenges of the 21st century. What are those challenges? And how grave is the situation that Europe finds itself in today?
Well, the starting point for this book is called Surviving Chaos. And my starting point is that chaos is going to be the dominant feature of our geopolitical and political lives for probably at least for a few more decades. And that is for a lot of different reasons. We can go into more detail on the war in Iran and what's going on in the Straits of Hormuz later on. But I think that is a situation which is quite different from the way that we thought about geopolitics beforehand, because for the last few decades, there have been wars in the Middle East, in other places. But typically, they took place against a backdrop where there was a broad agreement between the great powers in the world about what order looked like and what the rules were. And people sometimes broke the rules, as they did when, for example, the US invaded Iraq in 2003, or Russia launched its full-scale invasion on Ukraine in 2022. But there was a basic agreement on what the rules were and what the laws were. And people tried to at least make the case that what they were doing was legal and was right. And they would talk to each other, go to the United Nations, try and build coalitions and arguments around it. What is happening today is very, very different from that. If you say that this war in Iran is illegal, you know, it wasn't even something that was discussed by the main players in Israel and in the United States when they were thinking about how to launch it. They're not concerned about whether these rules are being broken when they're thinking about whether to bomb civilian infrastructure, to close the Straits of Hormuz. And from an Iranian perspective, they're also not particularly distinguishing between countries that aggress them, like Israel and the US at the beginning, and those that just happen to be within striking distance of their missiles and drones, like Oman and Qatar and the UAE and other countries around them. And we're in a situation where it's not kind of disorder because people are breaking the rules, but I use a different word to describe, which is kind of unorder, which is what happens when the rules have been overtaken by events and just don't have any purchase on reality anymore. And therefore, what is happening with this chaos is that it is outside of a framework of rules and laws. And we're seeing in the way that what started as a military conflict very quickly became something which turned into an energy crisis as the Straits of Hormuz got closed, and that's creating a kind of food and security crisis, a financial crisis, and one thing immediately bleeds into another. Whereas in the past, people were quite careful, even when they had wars, to contain them and to make sure that they were put in a box and that they didn't kind of bleed into everything else that was going on. So it's a pretty chaotic and difficult to understand situation. From a European perspective, we're both affected by the war in Iran, but you know, we have a conflict raging in our own continent in Ukraine, where another country tried to change the borders in Europe using military force, which is something which was you know, clearly taken off the table for most of the last few decades. And I think, and I argue in the book, that this is just the kind of starters. The hors d'oeuvre, the main course of unorder is yet to come. And that's because, you know, a lot of people in Europe think that the main causes of unorder or chaos, you know, are embodied in a man with an orange complexion and an improbable quiff. But I think Donald Trump is more a symptom of that unorder than a cause of it. And in the book, I kind of look at some really quite big fundamental structural changes, which are going to blow up a lot of the things that we took for granted, which are going to keep us in a kind of perpetual state of unorder or chaos. And we could go through that more if you like, during the discussions.
And does the breakdown of the rules pose a particular problem for Europe? Is there a sense that European elites have overinvested in this international rules-based order or this idea of a rules-based order over the last 30 years?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it has served us extraordinarily well. I think there was a set of institutions and rules which were set up initially after the Second World War, and Europeans were very well represented in these institutions and were involved in creating them, particularly the UK and France, but Germany was another big kind of beneficiary of it. And then after the end of the Cold War, there was a massive expansion of rules and institutions with the World Trade Organization, institutions to deal with climate change, like the Kyoto Protocol, and turned into various other agreements after that. There were discussions about international human rights, international criminal court. There was a kind of explosion of different institutions which tried to move international relations away from a realm which was largely about military force and the balance of power towards one which was more about the law and the rules which governed a world that was much more bound together than it had been at least since the 1870s, but probably ever, given the kind of extent of globalization. And this was a world which worked really well for many Europeans. Our continent was more peaceful than it had been before. You had waves of democratization as countries escaped from their totalitarian past, whether it was, you know, countries like Spain and Greece getting rid of their military dictatorships, or the countries that escaped the yoke of communism after the end of the Cold War and were able to become liberal democracies. So it is very painful for us to accept that that world doesn't exist anymore and to see it being ripped apart. I think that's often led to a sense of mourning and grief management rather than strategy when it comes to dealing with this new world that we're having to cope with. And I think one of the biggest reasons for that is because although it's been clear for quite a long time that the old order wasn't seen either as particularly real by many people in the world. So some people say it was a white peace, that there were lots of wars going on outside of Europe and outside of the West. But it also wasn't seen as legitimate because lots of people didn't want to have rules which were set by others before they kind of reached global prime time. So the global South, countries like Russia and China were very hostile to it. But I think the big change that's happened now is Donald Trump has launched a revolution against that order from the inside, and in fact has told a different story about American history, that America's the biggest victim of the American-led liberal order. And that, you know, does mean that it's no longer sustainable. And I think there is no coming back from this situation.
And I think one of the interesting recommendations in your book is that we need to very quickly adjust mentally and conceptually to this new world. So you don't just mention the notion of unorder, you also talk about unpeace. Could you just expand upon what you mean by this concept as well?
There's a great British historian called Michael Howard who said that wars are as old as humanity, but peace is a modern invention, and by which he meant that there are a whole series of rules that were introduced relatively recently, which explain how countries should relate to one another. And during times of peace, these rules have to be adhered to. And if there is a war that breaks out, it's only considered to have started because of certain reasons. You know, wars need to be declared. They involve military forces fighting against each other. And what I have argued for a while is that that distinction between war and peace has broken down. So it's a very, very long time since one country declared war on another country. And there's a lot of violence in the world, but it doesn't normally meet the old centuries old definitions of war. That's partly because sometimes this violence takes the form of other types of coercion. You know, it could be tariffs or sanctions or energy cutoffs. But even when war takes on a military form, it's waged in quite a different way. So most of the casualties in modern conflict are civilians rather than soldiers. Very little of the war is fought between people wearing uniform from two different sides. And that's very much true of what's happening in the Middle East at the moment. And you can also see how one type of conflict bleeds into another. So I discussed that earlier, that, you know, very, very quickly, it goes beyond the battlefield and it affects all of us through our energy bills, our food bills, and our ability to export things around the world, because the Straits of Hormuz is such an important choke point. And unpeace is one of the kind of components of this state of unorder, where things are breaking down and the old rules are going. And in the book, I kind of talk about how this is not just a temporary phenomenon, but is in fact part of a new reality. Because even though in Europe everyone talks all the time about restoring order, preserving order, defending the rules-based order, the logic underlying our world is in fact more of an explosive logic. And I use this sort of idea of the C4 world to explain that, because C4 is a pun. C4 is the technical name for plastic explosives like Semtex, but it also works as an acronym, because you have these four C's which are fundamentally changing the world. So they're capitalism, which is becoming more and more crisis prone, and in a hyper-connected world with really complex supply chains, you can see total chaos going on, as we saw during COVID, as you can see when there are food shortages in supermarkets and things like that. The second C is about climate, which is rewiring the, you know, we both have the people being displaced from their homes and the weather becoming more and more extreme, but you also see a complete rewiring of the global economy. The third C is chips, which is shorthand for the technological transformation that's taking place with AI, with quantum computing, with new types of a new fusion between biology and chemistry and materials and these other forces. And what they're doing is really fundamentally changing the nature of our economies, of our societies, even what it means to be human. And the final C is about civilizations, which stands for these big demographic shifts which are taking place. If you go back to 1950, most people in the world lived in Europe and America. By the end of this century, the vast majority of people live in Asia and Africa. And as demographic power shifts, so too do the stories that people tell about what's right and what's wrong and what's important. And we're now already living in a world of multiple modernities, where lots of people have their own ideas about how about the future, about progress, about morality. And that is a big shock for Europeans in particular, because we had all these ideas out of the Enlightenment of universalism, of having a universal moral codes that would apply to everyone wherever they lived. And those things all run into the face of these big trends, which are quite disruptive and which are coming together and creating a sort of compound chaos, which we've seen through the crises that we've faced in the last few years, you know, the financial crisis, COVID, the crisis of migration in 2015, and the sort of inflation crises that came after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. They're coming thick and fast. They're not being resolved. And because they're happening more and more in this world of unorder, we're not going to do a very good job at working our way through them collectively. But instead, we're going to have you know, a lot of disruption. And the big goal, I think, for European politicians is to work out a way of steering through this chaos where you can't rely on functioning global institutions, the United Nations, World Trade Organization, and a clear set of rules about how war and peace gets protected.
That leads on nicely to another aspect of your book, which is the contrast that you draw between this European fixation with ordering, which comes out of the Enlightenment and Europe's sort of intellectual traditions, and on the other hand, China's very different worldview, a worldview that's perhaps more comfortable with a lack of order or not necessarily obsessed with ordering the whole world according to some kind of universal principles. Could you just get into why you also examine China in the book? Because it seems like this is a main feature of what you're trying to do with it. You're trying to say that actually there are certain things that European elites can learn from China, particularly when it comes to managing change in a very disrupted world.
Absolutely. So the big claim I make in the book is that the huge divide of the next few decades isn't going to be between autocracies and democracies or between East and West, but two attitudes to thinking about order. And I give them names. I call one the kind of architectural mindset and the other the artisanal mindset, artisans and architects. So the architects, you know, as you say, they are people who think about what does an ideal world look like, what rules, structures, institutions do we need to embody it. They build these grand visions from scratch. And you know, America after World War II, Europe after the end of the Cold War are very good examples of that architectural mindset. On the other hand, you have artisans who don't build new things from scratch, but they try and adapt to what is going on in the world anyway. They often reinvent old structures, they reuse old materials, they try things out, and they improvise. And the best example of that in our current world is China, that has, rather than trying to preserve order in recent times, has been preparing for a world of chaos and working out how they can both benefit from it, but also position themselves to be in a good place at the end of the process. And one of the best expressions of that philosophy comes from Xi Jinping, the president of China, whose favorite phrase is to talk about great changes unseen in a century. It sounds a bit clunky to European ears, but it's quite a resonant phrase for many Chinese people because it sounds like the language which Chinese intellectuals and statesmen used in the late 19th century, in the late Qing era, when China encountered some quite big fundamental disruptive changes that came out of Western technology, and they were completely overwhelmed by it. And it began what the Chinese call their century of humiliation because they just couldn't understand how to counter Britain and France and other countries that ended up, you know, launching the Opium Wars and semi-colonizing and breaking up China. And as a result of that, the Chinese have been quite obsessed with spotting disruptive changes that were going on in the world before they overwhelmed it. And already in the late 19th century, so at that time of the Great Changes, You know, they went and they literally found a whole new vocabulary from the West, which they introduced into Chinese because they didn't think that they had the words to describe the world that they're living in at the moment. Words like science and democracy and progress were brought into the Chinese language at the beginning of the 20th century. And so they have been sort of thinking that we were going to go through these big disruptive changes. And there's a whole cottage industry trying to work out what these great changes are. But by and large, they're quite similar to what I called the C4, those four C's that I talked about. And the Chinese have been trying to think about where the world is going and to invest in those things. And there are some really powerful things which they chose to do over the last decade or so, which has put China in a very good place to cope with the world that we're in at the moment. So when it comes to the economy and understanding these changes in global capitalism, Chinese introduced this idea of dual circulation, which is basically rethinking their economy. So rather than thinking they have a kind of single economy, they talk about having internal and external circulation. So internal circulation is about making China more self-sufficient, making sure that other countries can't try and blackmail it by withholding things from China, whether it's chips or energy supplies or other things like that. There's a kind of obsession with being secure and building up stockpiles of oil and food, of all sorts of other things, which is serving them quite well given what's happening in the Straits of Hormuz. At the same time, they think about external circulation, which is their relationship with the rest of the world. And they want to make sure that they can get the raw materials that they need, the component products to power their industry, but also to put other countries in a position where they're dependent on China, so they can blackmail them. We saw that with the rare earths discussion. The second kind of way that they've been really investing in the future is they understood that these big technological changes that were going to come our way would change the way that our economies worked. So rather than trying to catch up with the West in the old technologies, they create this project called Made in China 2025, where they put a huge investments into 10 areas of technology, things like batteries, electric vehicles, quantum computing, artificial intelligence. And they've gone from being almost nowhere in a lot of these technological areas to being world leaders. Nowadays, it's almost impossible to buy a solar panel that isn't made in China. You know, almost if you look at the kind of car industry is bounding ahead and destroying a lot of the big brands in the West. And you can also see that when it comes to foreign policy. So you know, I talked before about how the world is moving from a Western dominated world to one where Africa and Asia and the global South are more dominant. And you know, about 10 or 15 years ago, China launched its Belt and Road Initiative, which is an attempt to spend literally trillions of Chinese yuan on building physical and digital links between China and particularly countries in the global South by building roads and railways and fiber optic cables and ports, and to link all these countries, which are going to be the economies of the future, physically in with the Chinese economy to put them in a very different position for the future, almost kind of rooting around the West. And anyway, those are some of the ways that they've been sort of preparing for the future. And they have not spent a lot of time sort of trying to, they've been pushing back on Western structures, but they're definitely not trying to build an alternative Sino-centric world order that looks like the hegemonic liberal order that the US created after World War II. They've been thinking more about how to position themselves to survive this chaos. And that's the sort of final way that I think they've been thinking a lot about the future, which is they have this idea of a holistic conception of security. So their idea is that rather than just thinking about security in terms of, you know, ships and planes and bombs and missiles and things like that, to understand that everything in our everyday lives can be turned into a weapon. So you therefore have to have a much wider idea of security. And Xi Jinping's got like 18 different areas of security, from information security to food security to cultural security, through to things like space, nuclear weapons, and cyber and other things like that. And that is very much about, you know, rather than relying on the United Nations or NATO or external institutions to protect you, they try to make themselves more resilient and a kind of tougher target. So Anyway, it's a long answer to your question, but I think the starting point is a different mentality when it comes to change, expecting there to be kind of great changes and then thinking about how you survive it, rather than trying to preserve an order, expecting that there'll be an order, and relying on a lot of external institutions to keep you safe. And that is quite a big contrast between the approach which has been predominant in the West, particularly in Europe, and the approach that China's adopted. And my fear is that whilst the architectural approach worked really, really well in a more predictable world of modernity, as we enter this very, very unstable world, that the artisans will find it a lot easier to navigate and will be less frustrated than Western powers that are often trying to stick to institutions that are being overwhelmed by these big structural changes in the world.
So European elites can learn from a Chinese worldview, a more improvisational approach to geopolitics and diplomacy. But what of concrete policies? What are the kind of economic, industrial, and geopolitical strategies that China has pursued successfully and that European governments could seek to emulate in some form?
So, I laid out some of these things, which, I don't think we should. I'm a firm believer in open societies and enlightenment values, and I love the combination of freedoms, and the quality of life that Europeans have managed to create for themselves. So I'm not suggesting that we throw that out of the window and that China has all the answers. But I do think some of the ways that they're thinking about how to survive in this order could be quite helpful to Europeans. So as you said, some of it is about being flexible and improvisational and being willing to try things out and see them fail. And then, that leads to different approaches in different areas. But, when it comes to technologies of the future, Europe's problem is not that we don't have, lots of brilliant scientists and people who, are able to come up with great ideas. In fact, a lot of the most advanced thinkers behind AI, behind these other innovations, are European citizens or have come out of European universities. But what we haven't managed to do is to create an environment where you can have frontier technologies being built in Europe in the way that they've been built in the US and China. And I think one of the ways to do that is to learn from some of the examples that the Chinese have set. So, trying to work out where the world is going rather than where we want it to go, and putting a lot of resources into that, but doing it in a way that is more improvisational. And I think what's interesting about the Chinese system is that it's been very, very inefficient in some ways. There is a lot of waste, there's a lot of corruption, but they have this odd mix of both having big investments by the state and subsidizing these new technologies, but then also having a lot of competition between different players. And there's competition both between different levels of government. So there's a kind of vast competition between different provinces in China to get AI companies and EV companies up and running and to move into these new sectors. Then the companies themselves fight with one another. But they do it in a market that's closed to outsiders. So there's a kind of Darwinian competition between them within China, but there aren't American or European companies that are allowed to participate in it. And through that competition, you've often ended up getting very, very competitive companies, which then go out and conquer the world, as we're seeing with like BYD, for example, the automaker, which is able to produce extraordinary cars at a fraction of the cost of Western vehicles. So I think that if you think about that from a European perspective, some of the ideas about what we need to do are in various European reports, like the Draghi report. It's very clear where that there are technologies that Europeans need to invest in, but we need to find ways of creating enough capital so that there are real investments. So both what the governments do, but also having more of a capital markets union. There's talk about potentially even introducing capital controls, because there are hundreds of billions of dollars of European investments that go to the United States every year rather than being spent in Europe. All these European pensions companies and other things are exporting a lot of their capital. And then also, our markets are very, very open. So Chinese companies can basically come in and undercut a lot of European companies and wipe them out. It's not that long ago that Europeans were dominant in when it came to solar panels, and now they make almost none of them because China has managed to collect to capture that market. So I think being willing to use tariffs and being willing to force the Chinese, if they want to sell into Europe, at least to make things in Europe and to transfer technology into Europe, I think those are all things that we can learn from China ourselves in the economic sphere. I think when it comes to security, we're going through a big shift. So I kind of talk about how traditionally Europeans have tried to get security from the outside in. So we relied on NATO, on the United Nations, on all these other institutions, whereas the Chinese have this holistic conception of security where they try and defend themselves from the inside out and become more resilient and better able to look after themselves. And that's something which is already changing. And you had countries like Sweden and Finland where resilience was always part of the national culture, and it wasn't just, partly also because Sweden and Finland haven't been in NATO for the last few decades. You weren't relying on the US to defend you. But that is, I think, a kind of mindset change, which is both about spending much more money, but also thinking about an all society approach to these different things and having a much wider conception of security. And then I also think in terms of how we relate to the rest of the world, China has often gone to the rest of the world and said that we understand that we're in a kind of plural world where everyone wants to write their own story and they're less preachy to the rest of the world. Whereas Europeans tend to tell everyone else how to live and to assume that we have all the answers to all the questions. And I think we need to find a new tone when we're engaging with other countries. And we need to understand that that other countries don't necessarily love the institutions that we love because they think they're too dominated by Western governments and and that they haven't had as much say over it. So I think we need to be willing to have a more kind of humble conversation with the rest of the world and build new ways of working with them. So I think those are some of the ways that we could definitely learn from the Chinese approach.
And will this also require improving our tolerance for risk and also the tolerance that our political classes have for risk? Because one way of reading the European fixation with ordering, of course, is to see it as a kind of obsession with de-risking the human experience and eliminating risk from what it means to live as a human being on this planet, which is obviously an understandable impulse. At the same time, moving into a more unordered world, are we going to have political classes who are more willing to take risks and also take accountability when those risks don't come off?
Absolutely. And I think that's exactly right. I think one of the biggest challenges that Europeans have is that risk aversion is almost part of the DNA of the European project, which is understandable given the what happened in Europe during World War II under communism, that people feel that they've sort of seen the worst things that could possibly happen and are therefore very, very keen to make sure that they eliminate risk from their lives. But that fear of failure, we've known for a long time is very, very bad in terms of having entrepreneurs and being able to build world-beating companies. But it's also pretty terrible for governments because actually, at their best, governments are willing to try things out and to improvise and to see politics as a laboratory for different ideas and then to help the ones that work. When your dominant feeling is a fear of failure, then you often end up getting very stuck and finding it hard to adapt to big changes outside. So there is a big cultural shift that is needed. I don't think it's something that has always been absent from European politics. If you look at the history of European politics over the last few decades, you can see enormous changes going on in Europe. If you look at the map of Europe over the last 50 years, There have been more countries that have created than anywhere apart from Africa after colonization. So the map of Europe has changed. We created the euro. We created the, we removed borders with Schengen. There have been some quite fundamental changes that are going on. And a lot of those things could have gone wrong. They weren't necessarily doomed to succeed, all of these different measures. So I hope we can capture a bit more of that because. When Europeans talk, the tendency is often about, regulating risk out of existence or even like putting things in constitutions in order to make sure that people don't do risky things. You've seen that with macroeconomic policy and the way that the euro was built. Decisions about tax and spend, which I think are quite rightly seen as the domain of politics where people should be able to argue about them. A lot of countries have tried to take them out of the political space and actually literally just make it unconstitutional for countries to build up debt. And that feels very, very wrong in a world that is changing very quickly, where you need to be more flexible.
So one of the things that I take from what you said just then is that there needs to be a kind of revival from within the European tradition. There needs to be a re-engagement with different aspects of what European history and European philosophy has put forward in the past, much in the same way as the Chinese intellectuals that you point towards, who are drawing upon the wellsprings of the Chinese civilizational tradition to try and live and operate in this unstable geopolitical environment.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly right. It's not about Europeans suddenly becoming Chinese, but it's maybe studying China in order to rediscover ourselves and learn from different traditions in our own history.
Now, I want to turn to what you identify as Europe's strengths, because I think one of the refreshing things about the account that you provide is that it isn't relentlessly pessimistic, and in fact, it's rather optimistic about the solutions that it puts forward. So, in your view, what are the strengths that Europe has, and how can it use these to its advantage in this new world that is emerging?
So I think that some of the strengths, come from the European Union itself. So, we are in a kind of in a dangerous world. If you were a country like Sweden or the UK or Germany facing all of these big unpredictable things, there's a real danger of being tossed around by forces which are way beyond your control. But by coming together as Europeans, you have an opportunity to achieve both. Scale so that you can actually help each other out, and you can raise sufficient resources and be strong enough to deal with a lot of these different forces, which can be very expensive to deal with and be quite overwhelming for an individual country, but also able to do it without destroying the nation states, which allow politics to be quite close to people and allow you to mobilize societies behind the right courses of action. I think another big strength is the welfare tradition which exists in European countries, which makes it less risky to deal with like massive changes in the world. One of the things that can make societies very fragile is dealing with these overwhelming changes, which can lead to really huge swings in politics. And we've seen in previous periods of change how you could get totalitarian or very or revolutionary situations emerging in different countries. But I think Europe has, through its political culture and its political economy, has an opportunity to try and de-risk these things to help the losers in our societies out and to redistribute the benefits that come from embracing these changes. And I think another thing which Europeans have is a history of, as we were describing before, there is this sort of history of inventiveness and of trial and error and a lot of competition, which has driven forward European success in previous eras. It was the fact that you had these small city states and nation states competing with each other in the Middle Ages, which led, I think, to some of the big technological advancements, which were, became very evident during the Industrial Revolution and the agricultural revolutions before then. So I think that all of those things are really great resources which Europeans can draw on. We're starting from a position where we're already extraordinarily wealthy compared to most people around the world. And certainly compared to, if you look at it within a historical perspective, the standard of living and the life expectancy that we will have is totally unprecedented. So I think those are all quite exciting things which can be harnessed if we have the right mindset. And if our goal is about adapting to a changing world rather than trying to preserve a status quo that's probably already dead and is going to be very, very hard for us to prop up against these bigger forces of history.
And you identify five big challenges that Europe will have to overcome: AI and technology, trade, security, and rapid climate change. How can Europe meet these challenges? What are the policies that are required to do so?
Well, I think in each of the different areas, there are lots of important policies which people are being already talking about and which will need to be adopted. We talked a little bit about some of the big ones earlier on when we were talking about lessons to learn from China, about technology, about security, for example. I think one of the other things which is really important, which I discussed a little bit more about in the context of our welfare attitudes, is thinking about how do you bring populations along with these changes. Because one of the most troubling things that's happening in the West has been that when the general population feels that it has no control over what's happening, it's often drawn towards more extreme political positions and wants just to wall itself off from the rest of the world rather than to engage with it. And that, you know, is the lesson that we saw with Brexit and we saw with Trump's two electoral victories, that a large number of people in countries like the UK and the US felt that they were being left behind and that they had no control over where the world was going. So, you know, as you develop solutions to all of those problems that you discussed, one of the key things is to think about how different groups in society are responding to them. And often dealing with these bigger challenges creates winners and losers. And I think the most important thing is to keep an eye out on the people who are on the wrong side of change and to work out how they can be brought along with the solutions. And if you don't do that, then the danger is that you won't be able to have a political consensus which will allow you to do the radical things that you need to do. So, for example, you know, one example I talk about in the book is on migration, where it's pretty clear that given our demographic position and the needs of a lot of our societies, but also if you just look at how much progress we've made in recent decades and centuries, a lot of that has come from people moving around and your ability to attract skills from other parts of the world. But if you don't have ways of managing migration so that people have got confidence that your borders are being controlled, of integrating newcomers into the society so that they speak the language and feel a sense of identity with the country that they've moved to, as well as practical ways of making sure that if you have large flows of population, that there are enough school places, enough hospital places, that you're looking at what it does to wages in particular areas of the country or of the economy, and that house prices aren't going up kind of crazily, then it's very, very difficult to keep consent from the wider public. So I think that shows how important it is to have an approach both of doing the right things, but also of trying to bring everyone along. And you could tell a similar story when it comes to trade and technological change and dealing with climate change and other things.
In your manifesto for reform, at the end of the book, you say that we need to think about these things in a much more integrated way. So we need to think about the connections between tackling issues related to mass immigration, but we also need to connect that with economic reform and also civil society resilience and also the defence issue. So these things are linked in ways that policies have sometimes tried to tackle in an individual sort of firefighting way, where there needs to be a much more coherent policy-making process. Would that be a fair reflection of what you're saying?
Absolutely. No, I think that's completely right. And that is one of the biggest problems with the world, that you have these big fundamental changes which are not acting in isolation, but all coming together. And so our solutions also, and the ways that we think about things, need to be integrated. We need systems thinking.
And you take inspiration in particular from Sweden and Denmark. Could you just reflect, you mentioned them earlier, but could you just expand a little bit upon what they have done well when it comes to innovative solutions to defence and also immigration and integration?
Yeah, so I mean, I think maybe it's partly because they are smaller countries that are quite integrated into the world, that they've had to come up with more innovative ways. So I think on the security and defense, we talked before about this idea of total security, particularly Sweden and Finland have practiced, countries outside of NATO, so they were less felt less secure than maybe many, and quite close to Russia as well. So there was both more of a need, but also you didn't have the American nuclear umbrella protecting you in the same way that countries that within NATO had. So therefore, there's both a greater seriousness of intent, but also a sense that this was an all of society challenge rather than something for just a professional army and for the government to do. And when it comes to migration, it's very interesting. I remember going to Scandinavia as a small child, and you just see seas of blonde and white faces ahead of you, and it's very, very different from going to I'm going to Stockholm next week, and a lot of the people that I'm meeting are people who are recent Swedes who came to the country within the last 20 years. There's been a huge change in the populations, and one of the ways that countries like Sweden and Denmark have had to adapt to that has been to think much more seriously about what is the national story, what are the values that we care about and that hold us together as a country, and how do we build ways of imparting that and allowing other people to join that and to become part of a bigger we, but also how do we give the public a sense that this is under control, and also, and this is the sort of third thing which I think is very important about Scandinavia, how do we make sure that mass migration or large flows of migration doesn't undermine the welfare state, which is such an important part of the national identity and the DNA of the country. And that has led to a whole series of policies which have been adopted quite recently, but which seem to have changed the debate about migration, particularly in Denmark. But I think in Sweden, a lot of the parties are going down a similar route at the moment. And anyway, yeah. And the third thing, which comes out of that, is the idea of the welfare state, and how do you combine flexibility with security? And that is something which is really important for all of our countries. You want to be flexible. You want to be able to take risks. You want to be connected to the world, but at the same time, how do you do it without making people feel very, very insecure, and without large numbers of people being blown out by globalization? And that is something which is a really difficult challenge. And there are challenges coming the way of Scandinavian countries as well, as we enter a world where the West is increasingly, facing much tougher competition in lots of different areas, and with AI coming on top of that, which is going to threaten a lot of the jobs which people are doing at the moment, is both going to become harder to maintain, but I think more and more important if you want to succeed in this world of unorder that I've been describing.
The values that we want to live by in our continent.
And finally, I'd like to ask you, sorry, finally, I'd like to end on a question about Europe's future. About 20 years ago, you wrote a book entitled Why Europe Will Run the 21st Century, and I can see a poster of it actually behind you as we're speaking, in which you made the case that the European Union was essentially remaking the world in its own image. Are you similarly confident about the continent's prospects today, or has the outlook for Europe changed considerably?
So that book sort of came out of a set of debates that were taking place around the time of the Iraq War, where a lot of people were saying that Europeans were weak and America under George Bush was strong. And there were all these articles about how Americans came from Mars and Europeans came from Venus. And what I was trying to do was to challenge this idea that Europeans were weak and that the European Union was a kind of terrible mess that was in decline, and to actually celebrate what I thought was an extraordinary achievement, which was not just rewriting the politics of our continent and the security of our continent, but also thinking in quite novel ways about how power could be exercised. And I said that the European Union, in some ways, it's the most interesting invention in terms of the exercise of political power since the nation state, 500 years ago. And what was particularly interesting about it was that it was a networked political institution. So we weren't trying to create a United States of Europe, but doing something which was different and more interesting. And so the first half of the book is celebrating a lot of the aspects of that and showing how things which were seen as weaknesses were in fact sources of strength. The second half of it was about seeing how relevant that might be to a world that was more and more interdependent and globalized. And I argued that the European model would spread both through the enlargement of the EU itself, because it went from 6 to 12 to 15 to 25 to 27 to 28 members. And secondly, by a kind of process of osmotically converting its neighborhood. So I talked about countries like Ukraine and Georgia and Moldova that are outside the EU being kind of changed and adopting European ways of working. Thirdly, by cr the creation of global institutions which embodied this European way of working, institutions like the World Trade Organization and the ICC and other things like that. And then the fourth way was that a lot of other regions, because this book was written, over 20 years ago, where we're creating their own regional centers. So the A Organization of African Unity reinvented itself as the African Union to be like the European Union. And in Asia, they had ASEAN and various other things. And so if we look back at that book now, the first half of the book, I still stand by every word in it. I really think it's remarkable, the creation of the EU. When it comes to the second half of the book and the ways that this was spreading, I think that I, made a mistake like many people did, which was to universalize a kind of architectural mistake in some ways. I was sort of universalizing the European experience rather than treating it as something that was very, very special. It's true that the European way of working is kind of spreading. So countries, Britain did leave the EU, but a few countries joined the European Union after that book came out. And there are 10 countries that want to join it now. Countries like Ukraine and Moldova and other countries still want to come into the European Union. But where I think I was wrong was to not acknowledge enough what a plural world looks like, where other people have got totally different ways of wanting to work. So I think that that is the world that Europeans need to get used to now, where they can have something that's very special and maybe a bit more fragile than we thought it was, which really needs to be defended, but which is really worth having in our continent. But that we need to work out how we can coexist with other powers that are trying to operate in a completely different way. And that is the big challenge now. It's about not so much about how we can run the 21st century, but how we can survive the 21st century as people who believe in the kind of open societies and enlightenment values, which Europeans have fought so hard for in their own continent, and how we can live alongside other political experiments at the same time.
I think you dealt with that question very graciously. I know it's every writer's worst nightmare when things from 20 years ago are suddenly dragged up again. But no, I think that was very interesting. So, Mark Leonard, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.